And good morning. In Providence, I'm Elizabeth Harrison. Rhode Island's large Liberian community got some good news over the weekend. President Barack Obama is extending their stay an additional 18 months. But Senator Jack Reed thinks they deserve better. He's introduced a bill that would put Liberian refugees on the path to citizenship under whatever immigration bill emerges from Congress. Reed says these refugees from a brutal civil war have earned the right to call themselves Americans.
I've been impressed with the fact that they're very hardworking, they're diligent, they have a reputation in the state for sort of being very positive contributors to the community. This has been a long-term and very close relationship, and I've come to respect the community.
Rhode Island has one of the nation's largest concentrations of Liberians per capita. There are roughly 9,000 Liberians living in the Ocean State. State Representative John Edwards is urging Tiverton residents to attend a hearing tonight on resuming bus service to the area. He says Tiverton has not had public buses in nearly 5 years.
My concern is that Tiverton has been cut off from the state due to a complete lack of service. We have people who pay their gas tax. My constituents have been paying their fair share, and we're not getting any services back in return. And RIPTA needs to step up and return service back to Tiverton now that the bridge is intact.
The Rhode Island Public Transit Authority, or RIPTA, suspended bus service in Tiverton in 2008 when a weight limit was placed on the Saconnet River Bridge. That bridge has now been rebuilt and reopened, and Edward says it's time to bring the buses back to Tiverton. A University of Rhode Island pharmacy student who spent 8 days living in a nursing home says she'll be a better pharmacist because of the experience. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick reports, the 24-year-old student roomed with a woman who's 92.
Do you want to check on your wash before we go down?
Yes, I have to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
Meet 24-year-old Emily Anastasia and 92-year-old Dottie Cusack. Despite the 68-year difference in their ages, they spent last week as roommates at South Bay Retirement Living in South Kingstown. Anastasia, a sixth-year University of Rhode Island pharmacy student, says the experiment was inspired by a documentary she saw about a high school student who spent a summer living in a nursing home.
It's been great. All the residents are amazing. They're so friendly, and they're all so happy to have me here. You know, everyone thought I was going to be bored or lonely, but that really hasn't been the case at all. Dottie taught me how to knit, and I'm on my third hat now.
Cusack, who's surprisingly spry for her years, says she loved having the company.
I like her. I appreciate her because I feel like she's a grandchild staying with me, and I just love having her. We just hit it off so well. It's great.
Anastasia says living in a retirement center will serve her well in her pharmacy career.
Really, just understanding what they go through day to day, the challenges that they have, but also how capable they are. There's a lot that they can do, and people often underestimate what they can do.
Anastasia says the only hardship was going without Wi-Fi. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
And there's a winter weather advisory for tonight from the National Weather Service. Affected areas include southeastern Massachusetts and central and western Rhode Island. Forecasters say they're expecting a major coastal storm to bring a mix of snow, freezing rain, and rain. Right now, they're calling for 2 to 4 inches of snow accumulation and wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour. The storm's expected to begin after 9 o'clock tonight and last into Tuesday morning.
Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Steve, you would think Boston, being such a big market, would be able to sustain an alternative weekly. Well, Providence might be a different story. It's a much smaller market. What happened in Boston?
They've been in business 47 years, and they've been probably one of the flagship alternative newspapers in the entire country, frankly. And there was a time when there was no paper any better. Unfortunately, or as the case might be, we have a terrible economic downturn in 2007 where literally millions of dollars of ad revenue sort of left the marketplace. We lost the record business. We lost the book business, the films. All these places found other ways to advertise and promote their products, which were less expensive and sometimes more effective. So we were left to try to get national revenue, and that just totally went away starting like in 2007. They couldn't cut costs fast enough to keep up with the loss of revenue. So they sort of reinvented themselves last August, and the Boston Phoenix became essentially the Boston Phoenix magazine. And they went with a glossy cover. It was a really high-risk but hopefully high-reward venture. The hope was to pick up the national advertising with the glossy product. They must have thought of a million different ways to try to save it, but in the end, Stephen just couldn't sort of justify the amount of money that he was having to put in to keep it going.
And Steve, I think the thing that's so surprising here is that while the Boston Phoenix is going away, they're going to continue publishing the Providence Phoenix. So what's different in Providence?
I think what you find in the across the whole country is that the large markets are losing their alternative weeklies, and in many cases, obviously, their dailies are struggling as well. What we have found is that it really the local product and focusing on local, being smaller, speaking directly to the people, you know, on the streets, is a much more effective way to operate, if you will. So we are the Providence Phoenix. We basically cover things that are Providence and stay local, local, local. If you've noticed recently, Warren Buffett just bought a whole bunch of local weekly newspapers. These papers can be very profitable, and it doesn't take a lot of people to run them.
And you're actually adding reporters.
We'll be adding, hopefully, one reporter. It's not set in stone yet. They said somebody misquoted someone and said four reporters. That was a mistake. We'll be hiring essentially finance, graphic design, production, sort of the back end, if you will, of the business.
So how have you recovered from the loss in ad revenue?
Well, we had 22 employees in 2008. Now I've got seven. We had to absolutely cut back in every possible area.
Now, what's your paper's long-term financial health? What's the picture right now?
I think the picture is as good as it's ever been.
Really?
We've been here 35 years. We're in a market that loves the product and has for a long, long time. The loyalty factor in Rhode Island and Providence is particularly high because we are their alternative.
And circulation numbers, how have those
Our
changed?
Our numbers stay the same. We put out 60,000 papers or so. And every week we monitor how many are picked up and how many are left. And we run very consistently at about a 95% to 96% pickup rate. So we don't want to print them if they're not going to be read.
And that's been consistent for about how long?
It's been consistent forever. It's almost amazing. No matter what sometimes we'll put a music cover on that might move a few points more, but it truly is remarkably stable.
Now, Steve Brown, in this instant Twitter online media landscape, what do you see as the role of the alternative weekly today?
I continue to see it as being outspoken on virtually everything we do, from politics to entertainment to art. We want to be out in front. We want to sort of give the angle that otherwise is not given. We want to give our reporters and our writers the opportunity to speak their voice. Hopefully that voice is something that our readers care about. So far, we've found that if we stay with our certain formula, focusing on a certain demographic, which in a sentence is 18 to 44, educated, generally single, and particularly the driving force is not having kids, so they have a lot of discretionary income and time. They can do whatever they want, whenever they want to do it. That is an important sort of factor of what we do.
Do you see a need to change any parts of your business model or the model of journalism that you're using to try to appeal to more people or different people?
No. I think it'd be a mistake. We have a niche. We have our market. To try to broaden it, I mean, there's no chance that we could appeal to someone who's just had a baby and is, you know, their life is their family then. They no longer need the Phoenix to tell them what to do on the weekends because they already know. And that's sort of what we are making. We don't ever want to change who we are reaching because we love our demo.
But is the fact that the news-consuming habits of your niche market is changing so much, does that change what your
How do you see
that?
I mean, the fact that they have Twitter and they have the internet to find things. I think ultimately people become surprisingly consistent in their habits. When I say the pickup rate stays consistent, they go to the same place. They get the paper the same place every week. We don't live on the 24-hour news cycle. We're not one of the people where you can pick it up and you're going to know what's in it because you read it or saw it somewhere else. It's a new product every week with certain consistencies regarding listings and just stuff in the clubs and the movies. And we try to maintain a freshness every week.
Steve Brown, from where you sit as associate publisher of the Providence Phoenix, what's the future for alternative weeklies across the country? Is consolidation the answer here?
No. It's sort of just the opposite. I think that what you're seeing here is us being given even more of an opportunity to do it ourselves. We know sort of the plant that we live on. And that's the same thing for the Portland Phoenix. Consolidation does not work on the editorial side. It might help on finance and production and the like, but it doesn't help your what you're trying to do with your writers and your reporters.
And bottom line, are you concerned at all that in the long term they'll be closing you down just like they did Boston?
No. I feel very comfortable that if we keep our costs under control and focus more on new business and convincing people that, you know, my target audience is really attractive, that they will come to us and we'll be able to make, you know, more money.
Well, Steve Brown from the Providence Phoenix, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Nothing angers taxpayers more than media stories about ne'er-do-wells ripping off government programs. So it was obvious that the report of fraud in food stamp and Medicaid programs had the headline writers working overtime and the talk radio shouters serving the latest sirloin of red meat to their sycophants. What started as an attempt by Ken Block, the computer wizard who founded the Moderate Party and ran for governor, to help the state root out $100 million to $250 million in fraud in taxpayer-financed social programs for the poor, has landed with a thud. This one is more State House Tempest in a Teapot than the Rhode Island version of Teapot Dome. Block is a brainy fellow whose wonkery is matched only by his flair for self-promotion. After he was badly beaten in the 2010 governor's race, where he received less than 7% of the vote, he offered his services to the new governor, Lincoln Chafee, for free. Chafee, with his team of rivals' philosophy, gave Block the green light to pursue fraud. But he also made Block sign a confidentiality agreement, one of the more astute moves the governor has made in this episode. The florid controversy over this report started with Chafee munching on his toes during an interview with Channel 10 reporters Jim Terracani and Bill Rapley, who badgered him over his refusal to make the report public. Chafee should have said that he would release it after state and federal law enforcement agencies and prosecutors vetted it for possible criminal action. Then he should have moved to the next topic. Instead, the governor fumbled and turned his fire on the reporters, calling them, quote, media hecklers, unquote. The governor's been in government and politics for 30 years, and if he doesn't understand that the occasional media heckle is part of his job description, well, he'll probably never learn. Then he waited 3 days to make it public, turning what should have been a one-day story into a week-long frittata. When Chafee gave it to the media, it was clear that there wasn't much there. First, most of the juicy stuff concerned the food stamp program, which serves 180,000 Rhode Islanders, many of whom have low-paying jobs and need the stamps to feed their families. The report flagged some prison inmates collecting food stamps, as if this is representative of the average food stamp recipient. And if a parent commits a crime and lands at the ACI, do we really want to starve his kids? But the biggest farce was Block's focus on the food stamp program under the guise of saving state taxpayer money. $350 million in federal money supports this program in Rhode Island. There is no state money involved, not one dime. Where there is a huge chunk of state money is in Medicaid, a joint state and federal program which provides health care to the impoverished. There is about $1 billion in state funds dedicated to Medicaid. Most of this money goes to health care providers, including hospitals, doctors, and nursing homes. Why didn't the report focus more on these programs than food stamps? Is it because the voiceless poor on food stamps lack the lawyers and lobbyists to protect doctors and health care providers? Or were the food stamp recipients simply the low-hanging fruit? When questioned about this, both Block and Chafee said that this report is merely the first step in a longer effort to weed out fraud. In retrospect, maybe Chafee should have told Block to follow the state money and go after the Medicaid programs first and worry about food stamps in the second phase. Liberals and conservatives had predictable responses. The right-leaning Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity estimated that $200 million in social service spending in the state is wasted on human service programs. The group also hammered Chafee for redacting parts of the report. State Representative Maria Cimini, a Providence Democrat, scored Block, saying the report and the headlines it generated reinforces the very unfair stereotype that people who need food stamps are scamming the system. Conservatives need to stop demonizing the poor and implying that these programs consume the bulk of federal and state money. Liberals need to understand that these safety nets for the poor rely on assuring the taxpayers who finance them that these programs are being administered with integrity and that the cheaters are being punished. Chafee has followed a prudent course on this topic, turning the block report over to state and federal law enforcement and top state administrators of the programs. The governor also has a legislative package to address program fraud and has beefed up the enforcement unit. But maybe next time the governor will be a bit more careful in his dealings with Block, a guy who wants Chafee's job. Block worked on this report pro bono, but as Chafee surely knows, sometimes things are free because that's what they're worth.